It's Thursday, March 31, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Our thoughts these days seem to turn first to Libya, and that's saying something, isn't it? Considering the fact that Japan is still reeling from a triple natural disaster of enormous consequences and the complications thereafter of a near-nuclear meltdown, a crisis that is still ongoing. Even as other places around the world are experiencing big stories, momentous stories of their own, after all, let's just remember that in New Zealand, the town of Christchurch was nearly destroyed by an earthquake just a matter of a few weeks ago. But in Libya, our minds are turning there because that's where the headlines currently are focused. That tells us something about the media and something about the way of the world, but it is now something of an unavoidable subject. Also because it draws to our attention so many of the most important issues concerning the way of the world, the way of a sinful world, and the unpredictability of world events. Now, you'll recall that President Barack Obama spoke to the nation on Monday night explaining that he could not wait until a massacre had taken place, until there were graves on the ground before deploying American air forces in order to try to stop the forces of Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi from a massacre of his own people. Well, now you have the report coming from Brega in Libya that forces that are loyal to Colonel Gaddafi are now advancing rapidly, even as the United States and its allies have established a no-fly zone. It turned out that Muammar Gaddafi really doesn't need airplanes in the air to accomplish what he intends to do on the ground. He's doing very well with tanks, thank you. Allied forces are supposedly now pushing back against him, but the report is coming in very clearly, and certainly was by yesterday evening, that the rebels are being pushed back. As C.J. Chivers and David Kirkpatrick report for the New York Times, there were few signs of the punishing airstrikes that reversed the loyalists' first push eastward into rebel-held territory. But military experts said they expected a good deal more to come. The airstrikes, as they were, did little to reverse the momentum of the battle. On the approaches to Brega, hundreds of cars and small trucks headed east clogged the highway as rebel forces pulled back towards Abadaya. They recaptured from loyalist troops only days ago. Some rebels said that Colonel Gaddafi's forces pushing eastward from Ras Lanuf were within 10 miles of Brega. One of the insurgent officers here, Colonel Ahmad Omar Bani, said this, quote, "The truth is the truth, even if it leaves a bad taste in your mouth." Well, this entire effort may indeed leave a bad taste in the mouths of many people around the world, as we're not even sure exactly what we're trying to accomplish, but it looks at this point as if we're not even accomplishing what was stated as the humanitarian effort. And then again, we don't even really know who these rebels are. A very important article was published in the Wall Street Journal in recent days by Gerald Seib, a very capable and competent observer of these things. Writing in the Capital Journal column of the Wall Street Journal, he laid out four possible scenarios for Libya, some good, some bad, and I would add some worse. The first of these likely scenarios is, number one, the Libyan army turns or collapses and the rebels prevail. Now, as he said, this would be the neatest and easiest resolution. But as we were talking just in terms of developments in the last 24 hours, that doesn't look most likely. The second possible scenario, an accumulation of outside pressures forces Colonel Gaddafi to leave. This, he says, is the scenario U.S. officials embrace openly. Well, we may be embracing it openly, but there is no sign that Muammar Gaddafi is in the least susceptible to this kind of accumulated pressure. The third scenario Mr. Seib mentions, Libya effectively separates into two, setting up a stalemate. In some ways, the military intervention by the U.S. and its allies already has established a divided Libya, with rebels reasserting control in a large swath of the east and Colonel Gaddafi in the west. Libya could descend into a hot civil war or into its own internal Cold War. Well, that at this point appears that it might be a possible outcome of this. But as Mr. Seib mentions, that leaves a host of vexing questions. What would it mean to have two Libyas or a permanent civil war there? For the last scenario he outlines, Colonel Gaddafi and his sons simply wait out the West, then destroy their opponents when the world loses interest. Now, that's exactly what I think is most likely, at least at the current moment. Muammar Gaddafi appears to be in a very weak position if you consider the allies against him. But this is a matter of will. One of the things that Christians need to watch as we observe world occurrence and headlines like this is who has the stronger will, because in the end, the will is often more effective and long-lasting than even the armaments. At some point, the United States and its allies will take their armaments home. The question is what then remains. Muammar Gaddafi has shown a tenacity in remaining in power, whatever the odds. Speaking of remaining in power, just in recent weeks, there has been so much attention to nations in Tunisia and then Egypt and then elsewhere. But in Egypt, there was incredible hope that the revolution that took place there, and that is the right word to use, the revolution that took place there would lead to something better. The great fear of this, of course, was that behind it all stood the Muslim Brotherhood, an organization with clear ties to an Islamic terrorist agenda. The hopefulness was that on the street there in Cairo and elsewhere, we saw so many young college students, clearly not members of the Muslim Brotherhood. Clearly, they began this effort, and there is no question that with the power of social media and all of their connectedness, these younger Egyptians literally made this happen. But now the picture is becoming more clear on the other side of the revolution, and it's not a pretty picture. On the front page of last Saturday's edition of the New York Times, you found the headline, "Muslim Group is Rising Force in New Egypt." Michael Slackman's reporting here about, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood. It appears that in the speed of literally almost of a lightning strike, the Muslim Brotherhood had made an arrangement with the Egyptian military. Now, when did that happen? It happened quickly. We do know that. But when did it happen? Well, the best investigative journalism on this is pointing not to when Hosni Mubarak left office, but to some days before, when the military decided not to move against the insurgents in a way that quite frankly surprised us all. They didn't move against the students. Was it that the military had a very good will toward the students? Was it that they felt a patriotic duty to protect their own young people? Well, it now looks like there was probably more to the picture, that indeed the Muslim Brotherhood seized the opportunity, made a pact with the army, and now it's moving forward in a direction that we certainly will not like. Now let's talk about someone from the ground. Amir Koura, age 55, a television producer, was reflecting on what's been happening there in Egypt, and he said this, "We are all worried. The young people have no control of the revolution anymore. It was evident in the last few weeks when you saw it. A lot of bearded people are taking charge. The youth are gone. They are not there." End quote. Well, that's a scary and rather ominous sign. Also, people there on the ground are reporting that groups of the ultra-conservative Salafist school of Islam have emerged in the era after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak, as well as a party known as Al-Wasat, which is intended as a more liberal alternative to the Brotherhood. Well, we'll see where this heads, but at this point, we are reminded again, as if we needed any remembrance, that sometimes the most hopeful moments in history do not turn out as we had expected them. Now, there is a point here that is of utmost importance as we review history. Most revolutions do not end well. Now, just look at the scope of human history, whether it's the slave rebellions during the Roman Empire all the way up to, for instance, these students on the streets of Cairo, most revolutions do not end well. The energy required to bring a revolution to pass is sometimes not the kind of energy that allows a revolution to continue in a healthy direction. Just think of the 20th century and all the revolutions that were supposedly in the name of liberty but ended up being revolutions in the name of some dictator, of some terror group, or even more likely during the 20th century of some kind of communist agenda. Well, that should make us very, very thankful for the very few revolutions in world history that actually did lead to something better. And that would include, of course, the American Revolution, which again should demonstrate to us just how thankful we should be that our revolution did not go in different directions, and competent and very keen observers of the American Revolution can go back and look at that period between the revolution and the ratification of the United States Constitution some years later and realize that during those years, the story could have gone very, very differently. I'm thankful that it did not. Looking at the United States, Religion News Service and others are reporting that chaplains in all the branches of the armed services are being trained in how to deal with the enlisted members and officers under their care and how to do their jobs on the other side of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And in this case, Adele Banks is reporting that the Army and other branches are saying that the religious liberty of all is going to be protected, including that of the chaplains. But there are those who are wondering how that can take place if indeed the military now has shifted its moral stance on the issue of homosexuality. An Army spokesman said the chaplain's corps' First Amendment freedoms and its duty to care for all will not change. That's, by the way, also from a slide in a PowerPoint presentation and a part of the retraining for Army chaplains. Soldiers will continue to respect and serve with others who may hold different views and beliefs. That's also said on one of these slides. However, as one group from Massachusetts is saying, the U.S. Army is now warning chaplains, if you don't like the homosexual agenda, get out. And there are others who are saying that at the end, it's still going to be very, very difficult to know how in the world a chaplain who would hold to biblical convictions that homosexuality is a sin can operate in an effective and faithful way under these new policies after the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Lieutenant Colonel Carlton Birch, who's a spokesman for the Army Chief of Chaplains, said, "Our training is an opportunity for our senior chaplains to have an honest and open conversation about the repeal policy, its effects on them and their ministry, and it's going very well. In no way are we giving the message, shape up or ship out," end quote. Now, I think knowing the reputation of Army Chief of Chaplains General Douglas Carver, that's probably true. And indeed, I have great confidence in him and in the others who, like him, are giving this kind of leadership. But the question is, what happens in years to come when the inevitable challenges come? What happens when those who are engaged in homosexuality complain that it's discriminatory to have chaplains in uniform who believe that what they're doing is sin? We're going to have to watch this one very, very carefully. Meanwhile, there are other things to watch. As if life isn't interesting enough, the Supreme Court is taking up a case. It heard the it at least agreed to take the case on Monday to consider whether a teacher who was fired from a religious school is covered by what is known as a ministerial exemption that can bar suits against religious organizations for employment discrimination. Now, the reason why this case needs to be watched closely is that this particular teacher was in the main teaching what are defined here as secular subjects. Now, just hold that thought for a moment. It turns out that the teacher was also involved in teaching daily devotionals to students in a Lutheran Christian school. So her ministry or her task there, her profession there, was not entirely secular. But you know what's really dangerous in this is the logical distinction, at least for a Christian school, between supposedly secular subjects and religious subjects. The Christian worldview doesn't separate the world into a Christian set of issues and concerns and a secular set of issues and concerns. The Christian worldview makes claim upon all of it. And the Christian worldview makes claim upon every single discipline. It just isn't possible for a Christian school with any integrity to say, well, here's our secular side, and here's our Christian side. This case bears very close watching. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.